All right, welcome everyone to another episode of Conspiracy or Just a Coincidence. I am Jack Allen. Thanks for joining me. If you're watching here on the YouTube, welcome. If you're listening to me on a podcast, thank you as well. So obviously, guys, today is a crazy day with the Biden stuff and all that. You know what? I don't need to say it. But I just don't care. I think it's all fear. I think that good luck, dude. Have you been to the DMV? Have you not seen anything the government does? Their ability to run anything efficiently is pathetic. So don't be scared. Don't be worried. You know, hold out as long as you can. But I just don't, there's nothing they do efficiently at all. So I want this episode today. I think it's like, it's so funny how like things work out, right? Like how, like synchronicity or whatever you want to call it. So today's episode is on the modern medicine system. And this book was really hard to like, Amazon actually corrupted the book. Like I bought it, I read all my books on Kindle and I know I should have the paper book, but like in bed and all those things, it's so much easier. I can just highlight, then I go to my notes, I type them up. So I can try and give you a somewhat coherent, I'm not a good soliloquier, so I need my notes and they just make it easier. But anyway, I bought this book, Rockefeller's Medicine Man, for I think 12 bucks. And I didn't open it for a while. So of course, past the return date. And I opened it up and the whole book is like, you could read it, but letters in it were like all screwed up. So if it was obviously the Kindle edition of the book is because I tried to re-download it a few times. Excuse me. But yeah, so before we even get started on this topic, I know very little. I mean, we blame Rockefeller and we accuse him of a lot of things and we'll get to like all that. And that's mostly all true. But I knew very little about Rockefeller and I'm going to read another one called Gary Allen called The Rockefeller Files. But just like what the historical people say is that I don't know how streamers do it so well with commenting and doing it all. But so Rockefeller, so his family, he's like one of six kids or five kids. They're in New York bouncing around. His dad moved to Cleveland. And in Cleveland, he works as like a accountant or something like that, like an assistant, has a high propensity for business. And he just kind of rises the ranks, gets money, keeps doing well. And then, you know, kind of the rest is he becomes a king, right? But so what was interesting about him was he branded his oil. So that was like real weird. He painted all his oil barrels blue, which is funny, right? Like, why would you paint them blue? And that was how you knew it was standard oil. You knew what you were getting. He was able to make it cheaper than that. He used every part of the oil, which is why we have so many oil-based products, like makeup, like anything, bags, anything you think of. A lot stems from him because at that time, it was like 40% was kerosene that you could get out of it. And he wanted to know what else could I do with this, the tar that's what we use for our roads. I mean, the dude was evil, but super smart, super smart. So that's why we have all these oil-based products, because he was using chemists and things like, what can I do with this junk that other people are throwing away? And he found this oil in Ohio that no one wanted because it smelled like sulfur. He was able to use chemistry, or not him, obviously, but people he hired to do it. And I'm trying to think of any other big things I thought were interesting about him. Russia, they were trying to keep him out of like Asia and Europe. He cut his prices so low to maintain the monopoly on 90% of the oil. And just, yeah, a really, I mean, cutthroat guy, right? Cutthroat guy. But admirable in the sense that he was very business savvy. And just was able to dominate a market more than anybody. Thank you. Very nice comment. So let's start with the modern healthcare system. So hopefully everyone can see this screen. The U.S., so Rockefeller Medicine Man is the book. If you guys don't know, I've said it already, but check it out. And I think I did the beginning. Follow me on Twitter, @conspiracy or JC. You obviously are seeing this, so hopefully you know to follow me. But anyway, all right, let's get to the book, right? So this book was written in 1978, I think, which is, you know, it still holds all the information. It's like still just as valid today and amazing. Whereas we're going to see like things, these people, as evil as they are that brilliant. As evil as they are, they're that as brilliant as that. So in 2019, the U.S. spent $3.8 trillion on healthcare. $3.8 trillion. 2020, $10.9 trillion. Like, is that even a real number? And we pay for this through taxes, health insurance premiums, out-of-pocket expenses. Essentially, every $4 that we earn goes to healthcare. I mean, like, needless to say, whatever your beliefs are on socialized medicine or whatever you want to call it, the system is beyond broken, right? Four out of every $10 goes to healthcare. That's insane. That is insane. So I think I told you about this. I work like in a like business development type of role in my career, and the pharma industry, like a headhunter kind of guy, and the pharma industry is so beyond corrupt. It's beyond fixable at this point, right? Like, there's just tons and tons of startups constantly opening and make more and more drugs that really do nothing. Like, so this, I think I kind of touched on this last episode, but to say like this one company, Biogen, they created an Alzheimer's drug that was brand new. Like, Alzheimer's drugs haven't been made in like 20 years, right? Because they can't get any further. So their goal is to cure Alzheimer's or reduce the symptoms, right? So that's what they go into phase one. That's their goal. They start testing. They realize, shit, it's not doing anything. So what do? They pivot and they change. So now they just need to prove to the FDA that it reduces this protein in your brain. So does this protein affect your Alzheimer's? No, it doesn't. It has no correlation. It shows no connection between reducing Alzheimer's symptoms. But does this drug lower that protein? Yes. Does it do it without killing you? Yes. Drug gets passed. Then what do? You market it, but you can't. Now the marketing people have to find a way to promote this drug without saying something it cannot do. And that is all the drugs that come out, all of them. Not all of them, obviously. I'm being hyperbolic, but most of them, right? So that's why there's just so much money, and a treatment for that's like $70,000 for a year. And there's rare disease, orphan drug disease, 1.6 million to get a treatment for like a little child. And you don't even know if they don't say that they can't, most of them can't say, oh, this will cure your disease. Sometimes the life expectancy is exactly the same, and they still market the shit out of it. Scared people buy it because they want their loved one to live. Oh, I'm getting off on track. So, but just a brutal system. Okay. So how did medicine become like so sophisticated is a long story, which we're going to go to, but U.S. medicine came of age during the same period that corporations and these dominant capitalist forces came to power. And the powers that disproportionately own the economic system also have other spheres of influence of like politicians, social, all those kind of things like that. So needless to say, this blood-sucking leech class created a strategy to develop the medical system to meet with its capitalistic scumbag leech workings, okay? So 1930s, medicine was firmly in the hands of organized professions, accreditation, schools, teaching hospitals, and the medium income for physicians was like $3,758. I'm sorry, I think this was 18. No. Oh my God. My notes, people. You know, I do it. Okay, here we go. So in 1970s, doctors, they're the top of they're 5.5 times higher than the average working class. As you know, they're higher level people, 4 out of 10 doctors are employed in institutions compared to the 1 out of 10 in the 1930s. That was right. So the median income in the 1930s for physicians was above teachers, but below like mechanical engineers faculty at Yale. Sorry, I was questioning what I wrote there. So you can see like how much power a medical institution has based on certain beliefs. So they create the doctors, they're going to teach them what they are told to teach or what they are encouraged to teach. And there's no questioning that. As we see today, you can't quite, there's all those memes like, where I did my research, like on your tombstone, right? That people make fun of people for researching what's going on. So insurance, public and private, developed a stable source of income, enabling hospitals to expand facilities. Blue Cross, Blue Shield, they control 40% of medical care expenditures. Insane, right? 40%. That's why they're so profitable. 1900 to World War I, the AMA and the science-oriented medical schools pushed for acceptance of medical science, which we'll get more into that as well. Hospitals, insurance companies, and med schools have a huge focus on promoting capitalistic medicine as opposed to doctors that used to have like a homeopathic rationalized medical care because you can't sell a cure, right? Or you can, but then they don't come back. So you see where they never do anything for our benefit, right? We can accept that. And I just have some pictures of Mr. John D. Rockefeller. So wholesale philosophy or wholesale philanthropy. So that's a new concept that comes out at this time. So New America, the corporation America, created so many issues for the old time economy. Educational, religious, medical, cultural institutions were all at odds with this new corporate industrial revolution world. The once dominant merchants, you know, people sailing on wooden ships, going to foreign lands with their home goods and vice versa, and agrarian leaders of towns, maybe like the farmer that owned the largest amount of acres and had the most amount of crops, all those things. These people were the leaders of the communities in pre-industrial times. And then they get replaced by these urban industrialists, bankers, crooks, essentially, right? So out of this arose, though, like unionism, populism, socialism, threatening, all which threatened the power of these globalist, capitalist, industrialists. Might not be too globalist at this point, but definitely they see the value in selling everywhere as opposed to just America. So these capitalists, they need foot soldiers, right? They can't do it all. They got an empire they're building. They need foot soldiers. They need captains. They need generals that they can count on to carry out their dream. And again, just to like really, obviously people work for people before the Industrial Revolution, but you were a farmer, maybe you were like an accountant, all these things, it was small. No one had a, maybe like East India Trading Company, but very few corporations at this time, right? A much more barter heavy system. And I think that's like just mind blowing for like I work for somebody and it's a small company, but you farmed, you would sell your crops maybe to a merchant who would take them to the city that didn't have their crops. Just crazy how much stuff's changed in the last 200 years. So these new capitalists, this led to corporate philanthropy. And like I said before, I will say probably like 20 times, philanthropy is, they're not doing it because of kindness. If you've ever watched Mad Men, which I love the show, that was like one of the last shows I watched before I stop watching TV. The one, like the partner of the company says, philanthropy is the gateway to power. And he is exactly right. So Civil War was a watershed moment in American philanthropy and history. So it stimulated the Industrial Revolution to a whole new degree, corporate capitalism, philanthropy controlled by the corporate class. Railroads were used for so much. Troops, food to the new markets, shipment to distant lands, cotton from the northeast or from the south to the northeast. And all these, like this, you know, this just sent, it was the first war of like railroads. Cause again, you know, thinking before that, you're sailing your ship, you're landing, crazy, just such an amazing difference. So despite the interruptions of this Civil War, railroad construction added 62,000 miles of new lines in 1860 to 1870, tripling the existence of track mileage. I guess those corporate owners of the railroads, you know, they weren't too concerned with the war, right? They were able to still triple the amount of railroads because you got to get your product everywhere if you're a leech like these people are. And it became, the railroads were the biggest customer of American growing steel, which brings us to Andrew Carnegie. Oh, let me pull up Andrew Carnegie. Here's Andrew Carnegie. So Andrew was, I'll wait before I get in. He's from Scotland, if you guys didn't know. But so he was a telegraph clerk for Pennsylvania Railroad in the 1850s. Keeps like rising through the ranks. He was at a, oh man, yeah. So he just rose through the ranks through the railroad, got more and more, kept making steel and railroads, all that stuff. I don't know why I jumped to end of war. So I don't know why I jumped to this. I apologize, everyone. But last thing about John Davis Rockefeller, he was, his Standard Oil was 95% of the country's oil. Okay. The Southern patrician class. So the South and the North, that war was just how they took down that Robert E. Lee statue recently. I mean, it was weird. We get that brainwashed. The South was the bad guy. And I think if there's some stat like high estimates, 4%, low estimates, 1% owned slaves. It wasn't a war about slavery, everyone. It was a war about a tyrant, Abe Lincoln, who was putting so much taxes on the South to give just to build up the North. They weren't able to make any money. The only way they could even turn a profit was slavery. So the Southern patrician class, after the war, brutally destroyed. But this was a place, there was no real industrial capitalism like there was in the North. So it was based on agriculture. And you can see why they got crushed in the Civil War, because all the industry is in the North. These guys are farmers. And they're kind of like an old fashioned, like they're the 1700s while the North is exploding. In 1870s, five businesses in Massachusetts were incorporated. That means like an LLC. I'm sure you guys know what that means. But that 5% held 96% of the total capital and employed 60% of all the workers. So just these, there was no competition. That's why I get libertarians have this view like, oh, if there were no taxes, there wouldn't be monopolies. I don't know where they get that from. I don't know where they get that idea at all, right? Like if we started today, I don't want to get down that path. But 1900, three-fourths of all manufactured goods produced by corporations. So by 1900s, the agrarian mercantile is over with. Civil War was the first railroad war, yet did not rely on an industrial economy, rather a produced one. And just like today, they lower wages and prices to increase profits. And how do you do that? Well, you need more people because you want to pay them less. So I explain this to my fiance all the time, you know, because she pays a little attention and she has a loving heart. And I have, you know, I care about immigrants as well. But the reason why the elite push you to accept these people, these illegal immigrants, and they brainwashed a whole group of people being like, no human is illegal. It's not because they care about them. It's because they want to pay less than what they do to turn more of a profit. Because if you only have two people to hire and they're wanted by another company, you're going to pay them more. If now you have 50 people to hire, you can pay them whatever the hell you want. And that's what they did. So in right around the Civil War and after, they brought 16 million people over, 15% of the population, quarter of the population in the new northeastern states. Women are also drawn out to make ends meet. They become 20% of the workforce or wage laborers by 1900. And they play all this propaganda, you know, feminism and fight for our rights and all these things, because they will never let do anything for the good of us, right? They did it so they can slave labor all of us and pay us nothing. Not me. I have a great boss, but you know what I mean. So depression in the 1870s, that brought down the wage from $1.50 for 10 hours of work a day. Labor unions tried to form. Well, Can't have that. So the Pinkertons, which was a private like detective agency. I don't know. Have you guys ever played Red Dead Redemption 2? It's one video game I've played, and that's who you're running from is Pinkertons. And I didn't know what the Pinkerton was. And my dad, like, so that's the Pinkertons. They were this group. The elites would hire them. They'd come down and beat the shit out of you're trying to unionize, you're protesting. They would just overwhelm you. They were trained to add weapons, money, financial backing. 1877, there's a nationwide strike against the railroads because they're getting paid nothing. Beckett, oh my God, my cat just jumped on my thing and scared me. Huh. So they put a nationwide strike down. It was a bloodbath. They killed people's families. I mean, these people who own these corporations are sick. Farmers that were once able to survive now require bankers in distant cities with loans, the lovely usury that always comes into play, and sharecropping. And sharecropping, like the farmers that once owned the land, they can't pay it anymore, so they rent the land to farm on it, probably just surviving, not making anything. Usury is like probably the number one reason why this world is in the state, usury and greed. And this is where we get the Republican big business versus populist kind of time. So McKinley, he was the first president, first modern day president, elected in 1896, bought and paid for by corporate capitalists and a nationwide campaign, which was like unheard of at that time, you know, like planned propaganda, planned ads, planned posters. It was, and so, you know, his message got everywhere because who wanted him to win? The corporate capitalists. They learned that with strategic alliances with social reformers, conservative union officials, political institutions, you could easily manipulate the populace. They've been doing this forever. If you listen to my intelligence in the ancient world, they've been doing propaganda on the populace forever. So you had sharecroppers, then you had Rockefeller with a 3,500 acre land overlooking the Hudson River, five times the size of Central Park. So you could say things were even more drastic and a huge wealth gap than they are today. Like people were living in huts with no windows, in basements with no sunlight, sleeping next to farm animals, drinking the same water because no underwater sewage, getting rotten food, no oversight on anything. You don't know what you're eating. You don't know how old it is. So it was just driving like the poor to poverty. So philanthropy back then was not directly giving to the poor. And Cotton Mather, which I don't know if you've been listening to me a long time, I did an episode on the Salem witch trials. And but he was like a very important in that role. Very smart guy. He thought that you should only give to the poor that could not work. He was a minister as well. And I think educated at Yale or something like that. Intelligent guy, though. Maybe not Yale. Could be wrong on that. Ben Franklin, though, he hoped to create enough opportunity where there was no need for poverty. He thought begging should be discouraged. Takers of, and then the general consensus were takers of charity were accused of slothfulness and degeneracy, which is totally kind of true. Like, when I was my struggle days hanging amongst the homeless people in Kensington. I mean, it was either addiction issues while they were homeless, mental issues. And there was like a small percentage of them that just loved it. I mean, they were addicted to drugs too, but like given the opportunity to live somewhere, they would have declined it. So basically it was like a social Darwinism. Those who are fit to live, do so. Those who are not fit to die. And that's all you got. You can wipe your hands clean of it. So eventually social work was created though. And so now you think, why would social work be created, right? The elite are pulling the strings. Do they care? Do they care about these people? The wealthy are supporting it. Why are they being so kind, right? It's kind of hard to keep profits and business running smoothly when you have people revolting constantly and wanting to kill you, right? So they developed programs to give loftier goals for the poor, get more comfortable lives with the products that they create. And what do we have today? What do we have? We have people living on government benefits who they give you just enough that you don't, you're not hungry, you're not lacking a roof over your head, but never, and you get TV, you get internet, you get a phone, you get all these creature comforts or whatever you want to call them, but you don't not have enough that would force you to go work or whatever, you know, try and get a job. And I don't want to get down that rabbit hole, like people should be paid more, all those things like that. But that's what they do now. They ply you with TV shows to keep you, and corn syrup and crap food. And they want you lazy and just to sit there and just listen, just do what they say and never cause any freaking issues. That's what they want. So they create compulsory public schooling. Now, again, why would the elite fund that? Well, it was to socialize the working class. And you know what? You need people smart enough. I think there's a George Carlin joke. They want you dumb enough not to realize what they're doing and smart enough to work the factories. And that's what they needed. So compulsory schooling, bells, raising hands to go to the bathroom, never questioning authority, etc. All school, public compulsory schooling actually lowered literacy rates in the United States. Prior to that, it was like 99% because people would, there was something like a study, like you need 100 hours of, when you're like old enough that you want to learn how to read, you need 100 hours of dedication. Today, the way they do it, it's extended over this long period. People still, you know, it's forced on them. Compulsory schooling, though, is not the, it's just an antiquated idea that was created by the same people that created our modern, and we're going to get to medicine, I promise, but I'm building this story out so you can get it. So the compulsory schooling, reading, writing, arithmetic, vocational skills, this will create the next class of employees for the elites to capitalize on. So they joined forces with the leaders and nations of traditional colleges, training scientific heads to direct America's hard hands. So you find the one smart one in the class, you push them to get even smarter to be able to direct all the, that was a quote, to train the hard hands. 1846, president of Harvard inaugurated a new era of cooperation between industrialists and college universities. And I talked about this a little bit in my Skull and Bones episode. They ran the college, went on to become dean. So the Skull and Bones guys got educated. They went over to Germany. I think it was, I'm blanking on the name. The first guy, not Roosevelt, but friends with, doesn't matter. So Yale starts Skull and Bones after they went to Germany to hang out with the Illuminati probably. They brought it back. All these guys, the elite kids, they went to, you know, to Yale. They get inducted into Skull and Bones, and they go on to become deans of Johns Hopkins and Harvard. Because they share these beliefs, they hire teachers that share these beliefs, and then these teachers teach from that viewpoint, and so on and so on. Woodrow Wilson was taught by a Skull and Bones member at the University of Wisconsin, I think history professor. And Woodrow Wilson is probably the worst human being in the world that's ever lived, most likely. I mean, I'm sure we can make some cases for some other people, but at least the worst person that was ever in America. I would go with that. Caused more deaths, ruined anything that we almost had. Another industrialist, Stephen Lawrence, gave $50,000 to start. Maybe it wasn't, Lawrence was the last name. I don't know if it was Stephen was first. Start scientific school at Harvard in engineering, mining, metallurgy. Ended up giving another $50,000. Did he really like rocks? Did he really like engineering? No. He wanted more people that he could hire to make more money. So this started this trend, though, of industrial people reaching to support research at colleges to train their workers. And science wasn't leading the way because of this. The industry was leading the way. The scientists didn't say, look what we have. It will save society. no. Industry said, okay, we can make money in this area. It's too old fashioned. Let's industrialize it. Let's find people that are smart and train them and sell their ideas. So like at this time in the mid 1800s, this is just so funny how it like connects to right now. These uppity weenie hut scientists were upset that anyone could kind of call themselves a scientist if they knew like how to burn phosphorus or whatever it is. And they wanted more power because they're nerds, because they have low self-confidence. They want to feel special because they're probably short, ugly, aren't socially adept. And so they want more power. So they should be given money. So the elitist status, they're trying to get money from industry so they can really focus on their, you know, pouring beakers and stuff. And at the time, they got no support because just how good or bad Woodrow Wilson was, Andrew Jackson was the opposite. Andrew Jackson, populist at the time, hated elitist people, hated them. They were so, like, anytime they tried to pass something that they sit there like, that seems elitist. We're not going to do that. No, that won't work. You're trying to limit people. Just a total badass. You know, beat back the Fed. Just a machine. So let me see where I could. Okay. So merchants and farmers, this was like not totally new. Merchants and farmers, they did make donations to schools prior to the industrialists. But this was like old fashioned. You know, they would give a large amount for most people, was small for compared to the industrialists, to help schools because they truly probably wanted to help the people. Maybe their community goes to this college, their state goes to this college, and they see the value in raising the education level of the country. But these corporatists, they weren't doing it out of kindness and out of love. So this started a whole creation of new colleges, like Stevens Institute of Technology, Stephen Van Rensselaer, he started MIT, Wharton Business School. Anytime that you hear a name of a college, if it's like a Ivy League or a lot of the tech schools, all created by these industrialists at the time. And I didn't know that. So maybe, hopefully you learned that was new for you too. Like Wharton, because this, I know Wharton Business School because I'm Philadelphia area. He gave $600,000 to train accountants, finance managers, et cetera, and to start their business school. He loved accounting. No, he didn't love accounting, right? Hopkins, Tulane, Vanderbilt, Stanford, Cornell. Basically, anyone who was elitist and they didn't like the gentleman Christian farmer merchant, that was, they created these schools. And it was cheaper. Again, they're not hoping to raise the education level of the U.S. It's cheaper to train one skilled manager, reduce the overall skill level of the worker. So you pay one guy more, you know, a lot more, and you pay the rest hard hands nothing. And that's what they're doing. That's why they're starting these schools. They didn't love accounting. You know, he didn't have a passion to do taxes. I guess they didn't have taxes then, but, you know, minimal. Abbott Lawrence, which is the one college. And I wondered if Abbott was the name of, it's a pharmaceutical company that got bought, but it was a large pharmaceutical, Abbott. And I wonder if that's the same guy. His quote was, "Let the hard hands do the labor." And it would make sense that it was the same guy. I meant to look that up and I forgot. Oh, I still have Andrew Carnegie up here. So they subsidized teaching in research, in natural sciences, engineering, pushing the prevailing curriculum. Like, hey, I need guys that can figure out where to dig for iron ore. So here's $100,000. Start a school of metallurgy or whatever that is. You're studying rocks. I don't know what that's called right now. Someone in listening is like, it's this. And I just can't think of it right now. But so that's what they're providing for their workers for the next generation. So generosity wasn't generosity. They were just needing workers. So college presidents, they would go around trying to get capital from these guys as they needed. And Oh, sure, Mr. Lawrence, of course we'll teach that. If you can help us out financially, I'm sure we could add that into the curriculum. I don't see why not. Yeah, you can see how this goes. And just so you know, I'm sure I'm going to mention it later, but today, one third of a college's university's income comes from the foundation started by these people. One third. And college is already insane amount of wasted money unless you're doing something that you need it for, but one third. So the power is still there, baby, right? Get funding. Oh yeah, so they get the funding, then a board of trustees is created who runs the funding of the money, and they work hand in hand with the college, like, oh, you're not, seems like you're teaching some good ethical and moral values here. We're going to take that funding and run. Oh, good. We're back at Carnegie, even though, when I was talking about him about being in Scotland, I didn't have those notes. So Carnegie was an interesting guy. Let me see if there's any good photos of him. I don't know if it's just like my pre-bias. I felt like he wasn't as, oh, here's him doing the hidden hand. Of course he is, because he's probably a Freemason. Look at that. I bet he is. I didn't look it up, but I'm sure he is. So he identified the accumulation of wealth as essential factor in the progress of race. Progress of race. Yeah. Survival of the fittest in every department, he believed. He thought, though, it was morally reprehensible to leave fortunes to heirs, right? So he didn't, I don't know if he had any heirs. I'm sorry. This book didn't like go much into Carnegie. And I definitely don't know it all. So somebody out there listening, I'm sure you know. So I apologize for not having that. But he loved donating it. This is the way I guess he kind of said, because he said it was morally reprehensible to accumulate wealth, not to spend it wisely. But don't let this change your opinion of him yet, because we will get on it later. But his quote is the man who dies rich dies disgraced, doing better for them than they would do for themselves. So already these kind of quotes, you see, he thinks he's better, an elitist, and the apex of human society. He doesn't look like him. He looks like he's bald and a little chubby at a time when no one was chubby. Doing better for them. Okay, I think many of the Carnegie's thoughts were older in life also, and he was cutthroat, just like everything Rockefeller did to get it where he was. But maybe at the end he had some regrets. I don't know. Maybe he was, I like to think of all these people as just like reptilian, evil, disgusting people. And a lot of them are, for sure. But sometimes I wonder, like, are they just human? Like maybe their greed blinds them, and when you realize you can't take it with you when you're gonna die, you say, wow, maybe I shouldn't have done, shouldn't have robbed people's blind so I could make 20 million while they could barely keep the lights on. He gave 20 million in his lifetime to universities. I don't know what that conversion rate is, but I could imagine it's in the hundreds of millions, maybe billions. Free public libraries, 60 million worth of free public libraries, concerts, public parks, city beautification, swimming baths, last church buildings, which I found ironic. Yeah. Minister, I can conceive of no greater mistake than that of trying to make charity do the work of justice. Minister, like, people saw this back then. They hated these people. They blamed them for all their issues, like they should. And this one minister's quote was, I can conceive of no greater justice than that of trying to make charity do the work of justice. So Carnegie, he started this like philanthropy before Rockefeller, but charity was making Carnegie probably feel better. Like, see, I help people. I give money for, so they have a nice library so they can go see a concert. But charity can, this is such a great quote, cannot replace the work of justice. Instead of doing that library, Andrew, you probably should have just paid people an honest wage, and you didn't have to make 100 million. You could have just made 20 million, right? And then these people wouldn't need your freaking library. And yeah, I already did that note because it, and so why wouldn't these people just, you know, the reason why these people wouldn't pay them more, because probably because they realized, oh, I have way more power. I don't need to be liked. I have so much power that if I just give this money to certain charities, like specified philanthropy, as opposed to giving it to the people who deserve it. And you give some other stuff too. Reverend Gates. And this is ironic, right? Like synchronistic. So Reverend, how do you spell Reverend? Gates. Reverend Gates. Oh, that's not Reverend Gates. What the heck? If you're listening, it was a black guy came up. And, we know Rockefeller wasn't hanging out with him. All right. Frederick Gates. So Reverend Gates, he introduces the Rockefeller line to wholesale philanthropy. Ooh, my screen is going to move over a little bit. John Davison Rockefeller, I kind of did his backstory here. Life consisted of work, family, and the Baptist church. Pinch pennies forever, but always tithe, which is interesting too, because like this Christian man that's tithing, even when he made $3.50 a week as a clerk, he gave 10%. Tithing is when you give 10% away. So just interesting, like how does a Christian, he must have been a fake Christian, maybe he truly feared being in, you know, eternally damned and thought this was his way out. I don't know. But anyway, 1881, he was giving away more than 60,000. Him and Carnegie are like competing. Carnegie's giving way more. He's diligent in charity, but ungenerous in spirit. He saw no excuse for poverty. One time, listen to this story. One time, a poor man on the street asked Mr. Rockefeller for $50. Please, my family is starving. Please help me. Please, I can't work. Rockefeller wrote him a freaking IOU for $50. So he didn't just not give him the money. He literally like burned him with an IOU. He thought it would be injurious to give him a cent. Carnegie was not religious, by the way, which led him to more so to the science religion, which we're going to keep going into here, as an explanation for the distribution of wealth. Rockefeller, as opposed to that, believed that God gave him his wealth. So total narcissists, sociopaths. Carnegie gave to church his last. Rockefeller, his faith was first in his philanthropy. So back to this guy right here, Frederick Gates. I wonder if he's related, dude, because what are the odds? And wait till you see what Frederick Gates does, gets into, and it's really interesting. So Reverend Gates was a minister, Baptist minister. They want to build institutions in Chicago, New York, and they're asking the richest goddamn Baptist bastard that they know, Mr. Rockefeller. And they wanted to build one where the old University of Chicago ruins lie. And this is interesting because that burned down Chicago, University of Chicago ruins, I believe, was right where the Chicago World's Fair was. So just an interesting thing that like that's the area they're interested in. Just makes you, you know, maybe conspiracy or just a coincidence, right? So regardless, Gates won Rockefeller approval, got $35 million in the next 21 years, fast forwarding through. So Rockefeller was very impressed with Gates. Rockefeller at the time, totally nervous Nelly, dude, a little beta boy weenie. Physical wreck in 1889. He had generalized alopecia, which is where you lose all of your hair due to stress. The dude had no eyebrows, no hair. So it's either proves the point that he's a reptile, or because Standard Oil, and it's just he's got anxiety issues. But Standard Oil's been dominating now at this time when he meets Gates. More and more requests from charities, churches, hospitals, colleges. He was getting over 50,000 requests a month for charity. And he really loved Gates so much. So he respected Gates. He thought he had a great whatever. And He said, Gates, come work for me. Come on, bro. You are good at what you do. Vet these organizations. Be in charge of my philanthropy. And this relationship literally changes the world. It rocks of the feller world. I tried to write that joke. So change the game from charities to dominating philanthropies. So before this, you have charity, you know, you give to the poor or to an organization that helps the poor or church. And now these guys are realizing this is useless. This doesn't give me any power. It just gives more people to clap for me. Why don't I kill two birds with one stone? So Gates, he moved money, these philanthropies. Gates was essentially like an account manager. He had tons of funds and he invested into like 67 different investments, railroad, mining, manufacturing, banks. Oh, thanks. Okay. 38 years old when he went to work for Rockefeller. So kind of old. So I said, Gates, smart, articulate, charismatic, not like our Gates today, right? He was minister of this small parish. Parish got huge because of Gates. He got donations from the rich people in Minnesota. That's where his parish was. He was just a mover and a shaker. And Gates found his calling as spiritual business, if you want to call it that. That sounds like jumbo shrimp, but spiritual business is what he thought that was good. So made president of investment, 13 investments at Rockefeller at controlling interests. So things he owned that just probably weren't really attributed to him. His salary wasn't actually outrageous in the beginning, but it became huge. But all of his investment into Chase Bank, which Rockefeller put a lot into. So that's why it's, you know, Rockefeller's Chase Bank, his bank, their bank. 1897, John D. Rockefeller Jr. graduated from Brown, trying to find his place in the world, and that his father is dominating. So he pairs up with Mr. Gates to worry about the philanthropy. What a weenie, right? Here's John D. Rockefeller Jr. Just a total, like, you can't even go work on the business side. You go work on the philanthropy side. Here he is. Hopefully you can see that there. Okay, so he was 23 years old, awkward, obviously, because your dad is like literally running the world and you probably think you're a king. He's shy, working hand in hand though with charismatic Gates. Well, his father is hated and he wants to help change that because he loves his dad. He thinks his dad's a great, good old guy. So they start the General Education Board. And now finally, we're getting into the medicine part of this. I know it took us a while to get there. Thank you for hanging in there. And if you knew all that stuff, but here's where we start. So $129 million was given to this General Education Board. Gates shared Carnegie's beliefs on hereditary wealth. And his quote was, your full fortune is rolling up like an avalanche, distributed faster than it grows. So Rockefeller launched his first grant giving foundation, the General Education Board, to aid Southern education. He worried about the South. Again, a joke. Did not worry about the South. They were bombed to smithereens in the Civil War, still trying to recover. Education rates and literacy rates are horrible in the South. So if you want to have a factory of workers and pay them the bare minimum, you can't just employ people that can read in the North. You need people that can read in the South. So that's why they donated to the General Education Board. Also interesting to note, by creating the education, you can control the next generation. Well, in the South, they still had militant populism stemming over from the Civil War, which is awesome, good for them. You want the best for your neighbors. And they had huge support. So you need to propagandize that out of the people through education. 1899, leaders organized a conference for Southern education. Junior was a guest in that. Wanamaker, like another guest, he had a store in Philadelphia, organized a millionaire's train to bring Northern businessmen on a tour to the South to see where their money would go or what they could do to help with them. All of them are in for the same thing. The Southern Education Board raised money among Northerners to push out propaganda and learning on their behalf, how to live right, how to read disciplined work, how to live thriftly. I'm sure they added some other things there. Listen to authority, you know, don't stand, all these things. Like Booker T. Washington, who I think is like, I meant to look that up too. He was an African-American guy, black guy. Obviously, that's African-American. But he was a Southern Education Board member. You see, this is what they do. They pick a spokesperson that can relate to the populace that they want to follow. And they're paid off. They're greedy. They want money. And they do what they're told for their payday, to just like what they do with superstars, to telling you to do whatever they believe. Like, I care what The Rock thinks, right? General, I'm going to just call it JEB, General Education Board, took credit for 2,000 more high schools in the South. And this just whetted their whistle, right? This just, they started realizing, damn, if we can see this power we're getting in lower education, well, let's take it up even. What's stopping us from doing it to colleges? So Rockefeller, great. They create even a larger fund, $182 million, today's billions, for the General Education Board as well. Like, they just kept growing. So at this time, the socialist movement is winning support. And you had, just like everywhere, you have some radicals, but basically people were pretty reasonable. They want to put a cap on wealth, which I don't want to get into that talk of all these things. I think capitalism is the same bird of communism, of socialism. You know, morality is what's missing in all of these things. But so they want to put a cap on wealth. That sounds pretty reasonable, right? That doesn't sound like stupid streamers that are like communists on the internet. In my notes, I wrote, don't go into down this rabbit hole. Okay. Yeah. All right. That's all I'm going to say. Capitalism, it's good, rewards the hardworking for the most part, but people that work 40 hours a week deserve to be able to live. They deserve to be able to enjoy some nice things in life. I'm not like a bootstraps guy. I just don't. Anyway, sorry. So regardless, 1904, Roosevelt is elected and he threatens to break up the big monopolies. I think it's Teddy, right? Yeah, obviously it's Teddy Roosevelt. In 1906, he started the litigation to break up Standard Oil because it owned 95% of the oil in America and I think 90% of the world, like just dominating. Well, in 1907, the kind Rockefeller gave another $32 million to the General Education Board. Totally uncoincidental, guys. He was really loving how many kids could read now, and he wanted to keep more kids reading. Rockefeller also was getting rebates on all its railroad shipments. That was another way that he was able to capitalize on the market. So he would promise a railroad company like that he's going to ship 60 barrels of oil each day, every day, no matter what, and they would give him the lowest price to ship it because it was consistent business. That's kind of what I think a rebate. I tried to research that. So the programs are get money given to the needs of people that they believe or the needs of themselves, right? Because Rockefeller and all these elites, are they giving to the people that they want a better, or are they doing it because they need something and they're, which they're obviously there, because they're pretty indistinguishable this time. As we learn, Gates' directives were giving grants mainly to private universities as opposed to state. So encourage Rockefeller to not give to state universities. Now, why would they do that, right? Why is he only, wealthier people go to private universities. Why are they trying to make them better? Probably because at the private universities, you had the same type of person in power and the same opinions as these elites have, and they have no oversight of the taxpaying populist badass Americans at that time. So it was easier to corrupt a private university that's solely dependent on tuition and funds as opposed to a state university, which is paid for by taxes. And these people, since they're social Darwinians, social Darwins, I don't know, they view the public as beneath them. So if the public has more control than them in a school, they think that's probably like hanging out with the help, you know. Social managers for a corporate society. So it's Gates and Jr. who shaped the Rockefeller fortune into programs. Managerial roles were developed now in government, department, colleges, social services, medicine. They wanted to make the nation's college system into like their business with trained, socialized professionals, managers for their newly created system, and the people. Carnegie messed this up because in the beginning, like I said earlier, he was giving cash for buildings and things like that. He wasn't utilizing his cash. And after he witnessed Rockefeller doing this, you know, he started doing the same thing too. So at the time, professors have a horrible, pitiful income. Carnegie says, here's $10 million for an endowment for a teacher's pension. Religious denominations were eligible. They had to have high school to allow students in. So you see, they're already setting the rules, right? Already, you had to have a kid that graduated high school to go to college. Cannot skip. Otherwise, you don't get my endowment money. So they wanted to have a system that intelligently related to each other. So if you ever ask like colleges why they all require the same things, this is why. It's not because they all agreed on the idea like, oh, this makes sense. Let's agree on this arbitrary process. No, it wasn't like that before. You paid and you go to college, you get your college degree until these monies and foundations started being created. 52 out of 421 schools were eligible for the cash of Carnegie's first 10 mil. And so 52 of them were eligible. So what do you think the non-eligible schools did? Did they say, you know, forget your money? No, they reached out to the foundation and said, what do we have to do to get this money? So turn Carnegie Foundation into the unofficial crediting body because they're giving the money. So they're saying, what do we have to do to get your money? Like, it's disgusting. It took over any organic and pure hope of educating your country because you want the best for these people into pleasing this elite people giving money. I'm sure you guys are all smart that listen. You understand what this means. 421 schools, only 52 were able to get it. And the other schools, they're barely paying their professors. How do they build new, but they can't afford? What do they do if they want to stay alive? So Rockefeller and Gates was the right man for the job. College needs a new dean. Will this dean help get the funding? So, you know, your college, you have a dean opening position. Well, hey, Mr. Gates, who should I pick for this? Who would be a good choice? Oh, you should pick him. Here's money, right? And you understand what I'm saying. You don't need punishment or force to do this. You just need bribery. Just saddening. Just keep picking the right guy for the job, right? The one that'll, okay, yeah, I'll compromise my ethics for more money. That's why I said no system works without morality. 1928, $50 million from the General Education Board, making sure to serve the needs of corporate capitalism better. It's all this money is going to. Engineers, what are they taught now at school? Taught to design new methods for machines. Oh, do they want it? They want machines to make better products? No, they don't want that. They want to reduce the needs of skilled workers and still improving productivity. It's not innovation and people just being like super smart building this stuff out of love. No, they're being instructed to build it so that we can pay people less. Separation of predominant ownership, getting managers who thought, that was another new thing. At this time, you know, corporations are starting. Well, you need to have people that take ownership of this company. So you brainwash people into thinking, oh, this is my company. I want the best for my company. I'll get a little bonus that's nothing to my owner, but a bonus if I care of it. And so you install that little thinking in the manager's brain. Now he's harder on every worker. He's requiring you to make these quotas because he'll get a, you know, 0.0001% of what the CEO is pulling in, or, you know, whatever. All right. So we see this happen to colleges. I know, medicine. Sorry. I hope you guys are learning stuff. I thought it was like, you know, it turned a key in my head. So American medicine in the 1800s. Back then, all doctors received training at the side of a practicing physician. Let's pull up some cool 1800s doctor. Here they are. I don't want this one. 1800s doctor. It doesn't look like the 1800s. Let's do 1700s, 1790s doctor. So we can see that better. All right, here we go. This looks like a solid procedure. I want this done to me. Anyone, it's just like a guy like shoving something up a Ben Franklin looking dude's nose. So they assisted techniques with the physician. They practiced with the physician, mixing medications, or they would go to abroad, specifically Scotland, which is interesting because Carnegie was from there. They were the most successful doctors in America for wealthy city dwellers. By 1800s, only about 100 physicians had attended courses at Edinburgh and over there on the island. And there was American medical programs: Pennsylvania, Harvard, Dartmouth. And these schools offered lectures to supplement the apprenticeship. So the other schools or other programs, you would just follow a doctor for however many years, learn, and then go on your own. These ones also had lectures with it. Crazy, right? Compared to today. So these uppity snobs, they formed the profession. Populace lived in countryside, small towns. These elite doctors lived in the cities. So like the 11 largest towns in Virginia had 3% of the population, but 25% of all physicians, because these hoity-toity doctors, they want to get paid money. So they're not going to go to the rural people that have nothing to offer them. So when people were sick back then, they consulted herbal practitioners, midwives, others, men and women in their family. And these people charged very little for their services. They literally would just charge what you could afford. Can't have that in corporate capitalism, right? Charge what you can pay? Are you kidding me? Doctors not making much money, so they instituted fee bills to stop creating so much competition within the doctors because, you know, I'll charge you $2, I'll charge you a dollar. Very unfree market, right? These pro-capitalists, why are they? I thought they loved the free market because they're not capitalists. Doctors were also less popular in this day because of gruesome practices. Oh boy, lancets. So back then, lancets were the rage of Jefferson in the Jefferson time. Looking it up on Google for everybody. See if we can find like an old time photo. Bloodletting, also known. So lancets, yellow fever, bleed them. Cholera, bleed them. Anything, you know, diarrhea, bleed them. Sore throat, bleed them. That's all they did. They were just lance, see like this picture here of them bleeding and catching the blood. Love to bleed people. Also, if the bleeding, and with the bleeding, they would give you some chloride mercury, which makes you violently ill. Jalap, which makes you violently ill. So while you were bleeding, you were also violently throwing up. Sounds fun. Or the doctors also would create pus-filled blisters to pop. Science, right? Science is always right. Science never changes. We would never make a mistake in science today. No, we are the smartest we've ever been. They'd also put some arsenic tonics on there just to top it off. Meanwhile, the less expensive herbalists, now they were probably fun people to hang out with. They were giving you cocaine, opium, heroin, and do some enemas, some stimulants. So if I have the option to get my bleed out and meanwhile violently shitting my pants and throwing up, I would probably prefer to go to the herbalist, right? And feel good for at least while I'm sick. And herbalists also had 100 years of, I know people like science worshipers will say anecdotal evidence, but they were taught by their ancestor and or, you know, leader of their community. That was taught by their leader of the community. So these herbalists, we use a lot of the stuff that they used then. It's just, now in a pill that the Rockefeller world patented. And also to make note is you can't patent something that occurs in nature. So like my example was when I was, if you listen, I was a heroin and crack cocaine addict. Well, there's this drug, ayahuasca. A lot of like hippy dippy people go to take it. And they created it in like a pill called Ibogaine. And, you hallucinate for like 3 days. I guess it like resets your neurotransmitters to make you not addicted. And it has a success rate of like 89%, like something insane. Currently 10% get clean in the addicted world. Well, why doesn't the FDA patent that drug? Well, because it occurs in nature. And to get a drug patented, it takes about 7 years, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars to do the trials. And once the FDA would approve that drug, since it occurs in nature, you can't patent it. Everybody can make it and benefit off of this cure. And there's no money in cures at all, at all. They don't want, we lose more people to overdoses, more young people than in anything else. It's insane amounts. And this drug has a 90% success rate. But America won't, FDA won't do it because they care. They care. They care. They care. Thomas Jefferson called the doctors inexperienced, presumptuous band of medical tyrants let loose upon the world. And how fitting is that? What would you call Dr. Fauci today? I'm sure Jefferson would feel pretty darn similar. So you had a chance to die of cholera or dying because the guy was making you poop your brains out. 19th century, they sought licensing laws, medical sex, medical schools, diplomas, all this stuff. So legislatures, they passed medical license laws to restrict the herbalists because they're stealing customers. Again, even back then, they're getting paid to do this. It's not about getting people better. It's not because they were killing people with herbs. No, it wasn't because of that. Bestowed exclusively on regular physicians the right to sue for fees. Like if you didn't pay them, they could sue you to get paid. And then a curveball happened. This was before the Civil War. Mr. Jackson said, this is privilege. Got it appealed in every single state and remove this licensing. So many physicians were attracted to homeopathy then. And homeopathy is defined as symptoms of a disease constitute the disease, and the eliminating of the symptoms constitutes a cure. Drugs that produce the same symptoms in a healthy person cause an illness. So like if you were healthy and you took this drug, that would get you sick. So example was like chincharona bark. It relieves symptoms of malaria, but in a healthy person, it will produce malarial symptoms. And so this was, part of homeopathy. Medical education grew during this time. 400 med schools were founded between 1800 and 1900 in the U.S. alone, which is a lot. You can see where my notes are at. Okay. Hopefully you guys are enjoying. I'm enjoying talking about it. So hopefully I still got energy. Sometimes after like the be talking for so long, I'm not a good soliloquy guy. So, okay. Yeah, 400 schools. So schools, teachers were doctors supplementing their income with lecture fees paid by the students. 1,000 to 2,000 was considered a good income, and med school teachers would get an extra like 5,000, and like the top ones would get 10,000 extra a year. So you can see teaching very busy probably, but did really well. Medical schools were often started by like rival political and religious sects, like Protestant versus a Jesuit med school, those type of things. So in the 1800s, they started this like dominance of diploma carrying regular doctors over lay healers. In 1860s, physicians outnumbered other like types of doctors, like a Protestant sectarian doctors, like a Protestant doctor, 10 to 1. So we're slowly phasing out religion again. That was so prevalent and the reason why America succeeded so well with morality. Inexpensive, lots of med schools allowed for tons of men to be doctors and a few women. So like many farming families, lower class people trying to rise the ranks, anybody that had like a belief that they want or, you know, a drive to do this, were able to go to medical school. Because there was still no public support for medical licensing laws. And so you're getting more and more people becoming doctors, which just like the employees, when you bring immigrants in, you lower the wages, you're lowering the cost and money these doctors can make. So what can they control? They can't get licensing laws. They can't limit the number. They can't set fees. So what do? They raise the medical standards, school standards. In 1847, the AMA is formed, raises requirements for to get in. And the AMA was like hostile to medical colleges at this time. AMA also denied the ability of patients to judge their physicians. Now, what does that sound like? You can't question your doctor. And also they would create propaganda to attacks on irregular doctors and quacks, that's their name, commanded patients to trust doctors. Obedience of a patient to his doctor should be prompt and implicit. Just interesting, right? That's what we have today. And not saying you shouldn't trust anybody, but if they are confident in their call or what have you, why is it rude for me to ask a question? Right? It's this authority thing they keep drilling into us. Leave it to the experts. Where'd you get your degree? YouTube? That's what like, you know, I see those memes. But this started back then, the 1850s. Don't question. Do not question them. They know. Follow the science. And this is where that obedience comes from. And also, this is not to say my wife is a amazing nurse. She knows so much. And this is not a knock on anybody in the healthcare world. They don't know this. They don't know that this is why this, the way these things are. But I was in nursing school for 3.5 years. And you learn a lot about like the body anatomy, which I forget. But there's a lot of things that we don't talk about, like because the pharma industry creates these curriculums, which is created by Rockefeller. It's not going to teach people about how to holistically maybe try to heal somebody, right? It's this pill will solve this. This pill will solve this. It's a one-sided approach, a financial way to get people's symptoms under control. Just like today, doctors won't call their patient fat, right? Like you have diabetes. Oh yeah, maybe you have bad genetics. No, you're just eating too much and not moving around. So the U.S. is overcrowded with physicians, no public confidence, nobody could gain a monopoly or make money. So it was pretty fair, right? It was pretty fair. So too many doctors, populist idea, stopping licensing, try to reform medical education. AMA couldn't win public support. And at this time, Germany is dominating the science medicine. And which is interesting. This is like, you know, 1800s. Interesting to note that Skull and Bones, Yale, you know, Skull and Bones educated at Yale. They got this from Germany. The first dean of Johns Hopkins Medical School, or I think first dean of Johns Hopkins, Gilman, was a Skull and Bones trained guy. You see, they're just setting up their people, dude. You just pick the right people and you are good to go. So my medical science came of age at Hopkins. The entire staff was trained in Germany, previously Yale or Harvard. And just a side note, the bleeding ended in the, like, the big bleeding ended only in the 1870s. Doctors still were using it until 1920. Okay, follow the science. I'm going to poke this hole in you. Follow the science. So docs started specializing now in gynecology, surgery. This was like the elite of the profession, and they're gaining. So how do they gain the public confidence? Did they inspire the public in awe with healing everybody, people getting better, living longer lives? No, they didn't gain public confidence that way. They did it the same way that the government, all then court, you know, the NGOs and the politicians do today, through public fear and ridicule. Where do we see that? Where do we see that? Do we see that now? Joe Rogan, say what you will about him. What do they do with him? Do they say, oh, that's, I'm so glad you got better, Joe? No, they don't say that. They ridicule him and public shaming and published fear. So they found their propaganda in science. Germ theory was coming to the forefront, and boy, did corporate capitalists love that theory. Is it because it's correct? External agents causing illness with specific therapies to cure it. Oh, they love science. They love science. You know why they love that science better? Instead of possibly providing your workers with a healthier life, not bending over in a little box working 12 hours a day with barely enough food, with no sunlight in your house, with everyone drinking dirty water. That would cost money to fix that. No. Instead, it's not that that's getting you sick, young man. It's because these things called germs that you can't see, they get you sick. But we'll get you a pill that will get you rid of that. Ugh, just disgusting, right? And I'm not saying that germs don't cause illness. I'm sure they do. I'm not a scientist. But I am telling you that up until this time, there were a split on the beliefs. Some people also believe, like, in germs. Yeah, they believe that. But they believe the greater problem wasn't because you have unhealthy viruses. You have viruses in you all the time. You have bad bacteria in you all the time. Why does it affect a healthy person? Well, because they have a healthy life. Right? It attacks immunocompromised people. So it's easier, much easier to say, let me pay you an extra $30 an hour so you and your family can eat healthy food and not live in filth. It's much easier to say, here, come to the doctor, and actually you're going to pay me for that. You're going to pay me for that, and I'm going to take away your symptoms. I talked about this a few times, Jenner, cowpox. You know, there was the whole story of that. Oh, God, dude. He did it to five people. He said he cured them. They got it. Some died. They went with it, though. They went with it because they saw the financial capabilities of that type of mentality. 1866, cholera kept happening. Finally realized they had to clean up the filth in cities. And in the 1890s, they created diphtheria antitoxin, plauded in the history books. It saved everyone. It saved America. They saved us. Also, what preceded the diphtheria antitoxin was underground plumbing. So now people aren't drinking the same water that's infested with your livestock's feces. That would probably have a big play on it too, right? But medicine, savior science, they saved us all. So this got new respect from the political sphere and the financial sphere. German government was giving labs for Coke, Koch, I guess. Him and Pasteur didn't see eye. He believed in terrain theory, which is like your body. That's what gets you sick. You have something off in your gut. Stuff like that. France, Great Institute for Pasteur, England, Japan, and private philanthropy, they're creating labs for scientists. So US, they say, you know, we like giving stuff to people too. Let's get in on this game. So they, and prior to 1885, the labs, there was no interest in creating labs to study humans. Why? Because you didn't make any money healing a human. What do you make? What do they have all the science? What was that dedicated in? Oh, and how to keep your livestock alive. That's why it didn't exist before. They had stuff, but it was focused on livestock. Isn't that just disgusting? That's how can you trust anything these people say? Not like, you know, not your neighborhood person. And these people at the top, like, they act like I'm an idiot for questioning them. Dude, your whole career is so corrupt and disgusting and lying and cheating. How would you expect that I believe Bill Gates wants me better, wants me to live a long, healthy life? Really? Then why did you pay yourself, man, why are you worth billions while you're workers, like the janitor, I'm sure your building makes barely enough to survive. Oh, but now you care about me. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So that's why there was none of this research before 1885, because they were doing it on animals, not on humans. But then in the 1890s, here comes the magazine, here comes the newspapers, here come the journals, all praising modern medicine. It's an exact science. It's worth paying for. Medicine is an art. Homeopathy, quackery, stupid. Do you see the kind of like the connections between today and then? It's just crazy, right? Families and healers, they had cures for generations. This time you had some, and at this time you're like getting split. You have these old time doctors that did homeopathy, and now, you know, modern medicine is catching up to them, and they're able to kind of use the best of both worlds, right? They didn't fully buy into this, like a cure exists only in a pill or a medicine. You know, you need something like healthier, something's hurting you, and maybe this could help you. A lot of them will refuse patent medicines. And so if you can't suppress their success, these people that are still doing the old ways, even with the new arts of science, what do? Well, you ridicule them, you create propaganda, and you create fear, because cures are not profitable. Oh, thanks for coming, dude. New academic. So medical profession, it had to look, sound, talk elitist. Scientists are gaining more and more power, looking down on actual practicing physicians. Kind of like, what is Fauci? He's like one of these scientists in the 1890s. So 1893, Hopkins became the first med school to employ just scientists in the lab as full-time faculty. Before that, like I said, doctors did this to supplement their income. But these scientists, they became the new symbol of the profession. They get control over the AMA, the profession's instrument of political action. And what do? They say, you know what? We're going to judge medical schools and evaluate on the standards like we have here at Johns Hopkins, funded by Mr. Johns Hopkins, an elite person, funded by other things, because we know what's best. We know what's best. So we're going to judge you. So now to evaluate these schools, Johns Hopkins has a huge lab with scientists just doing science, not doing practice. And most medical schools at the time, I told you there's over 400 of them, they could barely pay their salaries of their teachers. And to have solely dedicated researchers, they can't afford that. They can't pay these huge salaries for people. So if you didn't have the labs, if you didn't have all this new modern artistic science, you probably couldn't teach the kids how to pass the new licensing exams. So students aren't going to go to your school to pay you cash to teach them if they're not going to be able to pass the test afterwards. So 1905, it's like the first AMA super scienced up. They had a council on medical education. And in 5 years, 30 med schools merged, 21 closed down together. What does this have success doing? Well, I told you 20 years prior, doctors weren't getting paid enough because there were too many physicians, because 400 medical schools. Well, now that you just shut down a fifth of the schools, this reduces production of physicians, eases competition, then the AMA says, in order to get to med school, you actually need a preliminary degree like we have today. And this is because they want elite people. They don't want a low-class doctor. They want the wealthy gentleman. It was the AMA even looked down and poo-pooed and ridiculed sundown institutions. Sundown institution meant medical schools that were ran at night so somebody could work and pay for college. And this was back in the day that you could do this because college wasn't absurdly priced for nothing. So now some bigwigs, they were calling out this elitism because there's still some Andrew Jackson populism that exists. But when corporate capitalism is behind you, dissenters have no voice. So Skull and Bones, they start as they led the way of the gold standard, require a bachelor degree before admission, unlimited funds. They set the standards. Everyone must conform to their way. They are the best. You need to follow our lead, or you will not get funded by Rockefeller Foundation, by Carnegie Foundation. In 1901, Hopkins went from 198 students to 67. Is it because the other doctors weren't good? No, it was because they're weeding out the socially unfit that can't afford it, that they don't want representing their school. Now, homeopathy was, even though it was ridiculed, it still was a formidable competitor. Well, what'd they do? They ridiculed it. That didn't work. They tried to create fear. That didn't work. Well, you know what? Foundations of the elites, Rockefeller, all of them, they gave funds to start their own homeopathic colleges. Became bigger than the other homeopathic schools, you remove the competition. So you can guess the curriculum didn't really change. It was maybe just a little more homeopathic than the regular schools. Like, what's the difference between a DO and an MD? Very little. Is an OD or DO? I don't, you know, there's a doctor of obstetrician. I think a DO. There's barely any difference. Is one more likely to give you a medicine before the other? Yeah. Besides that, is there any difference? 33 out of 45 states act like Hopkins. Let me see. I think we're gonna wrap it up there. Let me just put, all right. So I talked about specialization. 1890s, gynecological surgeons were in a gold rush. AMA encouraged referrals by giving kickbacks to general practitioners. This lowered the amount of general practitioners because why not specialize and make more money? So they went from 100,000 to 60,000 doctors. So propaganda successfully selling scientific medicine as the last word of health and disease. The doctor was portrayed as omniscient, and skill is all powerful. Along with infallibility comes sort of malpractice suits because these doctors are supposed to be perfect. What's the second cause of death in hospitals? But obedience, do not question. If you question, you're an idiot. You're a crazy person, insane. All right, that's where I end here. So I'm almost done with the book. I had to do this in two parts because I can't, 2-hour shows are just too long. This way I can like put out more. So I'm going to put out, I already have like a lot of the notes for the next one. So we'll finish this one maybe like Saturday or Sunday, or maybe Monday. I don't know. See how much farther I get. So guys, thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for the people that were with me on YouTube here. I'm Jack Allen. Follow me on Twitter at Conspiracy or JC. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. I would love to get it monetized because I try not to say anything that could get me kicked off. But, you know, I love doing this. I love it. But any little bit helps. I have a Patreon if you ever do want to support, or you can like even a Venmo if you want to buy a book for me that I'm about to buy. I'll credit the episode to you. But it's tough times. I don't, you know, totally get it. So if you ever could leave a review though, I'd be eternally grateful. I love reading the reviews. They truly mean a lot, guys. And my last thing I'm going to say tonight is there's a lot of craziness that goes on in this world, like with what Biden said today about the mandating and things like that. And, you know, I'm not going to, I'm lucky. I don't think I work at a big enough thing, but just hang in there. Don't let them rattle you. They can't do this. Even if they can, have faith in God. Here, find a loved one, family, and it's going to be okay. Like, this isn't, it's just, if you give into their fear, dude, they're going to win. They're going to abuse you and take every sane of happiness and enjoyment you have out of life. And you just can't let them do that to you, to us, right? We know they're disgusting. And more people each day are seeing that they're liars, and the people that won't, we're not going to get them, dude. They are too far gone, but they are small and few between. Most people are hip to what's going on in this world, and our numbers will just continue to grow. So hang in there, everybody. I'm Jack Allen, at Conspiracy or JC. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll do part two real soon and continue. We'll get really into how Rockefeller created all these funds and all this other stuff about why our medical system is the way it is today. Hope you enjoyed it. Follow me on Twitter. I'm out. Have a good day, Friday. Enjoy it. Peace.